ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
These monumental structures, places which have power embedded in them. This speaks to power.
Artist, activist Richard Bell brings the spirit of the Aboriginal Tent Embassy to the heart of Empire, and he's telling up Rent Owed. This is The Art Show. I'm Rosa Allen, coming to you from Wurundjeri land this episode, where political artists speak to urgent times. David McDermott lost his life to AIDS at the age of 45, but his work has lived on thanks to a cannily planned artist's estate.
Denial wasn't really the way to go. You had to face the fact that this was it, and if you wanted your work to live on, you had to make a plan.
And I'll step into the studio of a wood turner who plays with fire. That's all coming up here on The Art Show. He's one of Australia's leading contemporary artists, and after a run at Documenta 15 in Germany, Richard Bell has taken centre stage in one of the most hallowed spaces for contemporary art. I'm talking about the Tate Modern in London. Richard is having the success that an artist half his age might expect, but very few actually reach. And his practice isn't slowing. The sale of one of his artworks on the secondary art market drew a record price for him when it was auctioned last year at Sotheby's. Now, The Art Show's Daniel Browning has been in London for Richard's show and the installation of two artworks that are highly conceptual. A simple but elegant bank of LED screens, a ticker like you might see on the floor of a stock exchange, and an army tent. And that's the latest incarnation of his ongoing project, which relives a pivotal moment in black history. Daniel spoke to Richard at the busy Turbine Hall. That's when they weren't being interrupted by security.
I'm Richard Bell. I'm an artist, operates out of Brisbane mostly, and we're standing in front of the Tate Modern with a giant orange sign with white lettering that says, "Welcome to Tate Modern."
Not just the Tate Modern, this is the Turbine Hall.
This is where
artists like Ai Weiwei, Kara Walker, Anish Kapoor have had this space. This is a highly visible... it's one of the most prestigious spaces to exhibit your work in. We're walking through the front doors of the Tate Modern. We've just walked in. Standing in front of this work, tell me about what we see.
This work is, it's a digital counter that shows the amount of money that the British government owes Aboriginal people for the rent of our lands since 1788 until 1901, when they handed over to these local yokels.
So this figure relates to the British government.
Yes.
It's not the Australian government.
No.
It's the coloniser.
Yes.
You're bringing it back home.
Yeah, well, this is the heart of the empire, the heart of the beast, so to speak. The beast that was the British colonial government. And so this is where it all began. And the original Tate is situated in Millbank, where the convicts who were sent to Australia left from. So the word POM comes from prisoner of Millbank.
I'm just learning this history about Millbank and how central it was to the transportation policy. This number, though, can we talk about how many we've got? I don't know how many digits we've got here.
I don't know. There's
a lot of numbers.
Hundreds of millions. I don't know, maybe it's a quadrillion. I don't know what comes after trillions. I'll have to Google it.
But there's something really meditative about this endless enumeration.
Yeah.
What do you want people to meditate on? The British public.
Okay, well, they should understand that we understand that the number is so big that there's no possibility of them ever repaying it. We have to come to some sort of arrangement, some sort of agreement, about what they can do that would help us, get us out of our situation, you know. And that obviously means land back, but also, you know, compensation, you know, like reparations, if you would. So, and this is just for the rent of the land, not for ownership of it, not for all the resources that they stole either.
It's just compensation for what's been taken.
This is the rent. They didn't pay the rent.
It does not confer ownership.
No.
It just is paid for what you've already taken.
Yes. Yeah, your time spent there. You're like the back rent, you know, so to speak. You're like... if you look at it from the capitalist point of view, there's your compound interest, which, you know, keeps, you know, churning over with the money. So you look at these figures here, you're like, okay, we're getting close to 1 million. It looks like every second there's, I think so, we've already gone up 1 million.
There are 18 digits. I just counted them. And the top figure is 666.
Wait there.
Quintillion, quadrillion. We're passing underneath the ticker, which is, you know, composed of very powerful LED boxes, and it's been built into the structure of this awning here. It's unavoidable.
Yes.
I mean, how do you feel when you see that number projected here?
You were in
documented.
Oh yeah.
This is the life of an artist.
Oh, not too bad. Fellow artist from Documenta.
Now, the work that was at Documenta was different in the sense that it wasn't at the rent that the Australian government.
Yes.
So this is a different figure, and a different iteration of that work.
Unfortunately, what we have in Australia is we have a property dispute that's been turned into a race debate, and that's how they dispossess us.
This is a statement that you make in a work which always needs explanation. It needs explaining. A property dispute turned into a race debate, because that's the crux of the problem.
Yes. Once you bring in race into the debate, it just descends into a fight.
At the heart of our conflict of Aboriginal people, of the conflict we have with the nation state, is a property dispute.
Yeah.
Who owns the land?
Yeah, we own the land, yes. We'll always own the land, regardless. So,
you okay?
Obviously.
You okay? Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
This is the artist.
You are the artist.
Yeah.
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 Are you
yes.
working?
Yeah, Helen O'Malley was here before.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm for security. do we have a right to be here, Richard? the property dispute is the core of the issue.
Yes, it's all about the land. It's all about the property. Like, that's the basis of our argument. So, for reparations, some kind of power sharing.
We're okay. We've already spoken to your colleague.
Yeah.
Sorry. What is this all about?
I'm
the artist.
No.
I'm from Australia, the art show. Yeah.
And when we have permission from the party, you've got permission to do
this? Yes.
Okay. I've never got any corresponding of you when you're there, you see. I'm the artist.
We'll have to stop there because security are here. We're all right now. We're all right now. So, Richard, we've come up to the second level of the Tate Modern, and what you've done is erected this embassy, which appears like the TARDIS all over the world. But here at the Tate Modern, you've recreated... Well, this is your creation, the embassy. Tell me about the ongoing nature of this project, because it's been running for, 12, 13 years?
Just 10 years. This is the first
10th anniversary.
The first time was in February 2013. Me and Foley did it at Monash University.
I was there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was the
we
first
had AstroTurf
one.
And some, yeah, some white plastic chairs and an umbrella.
And a beach umbrella, yeah. Yeah.
We've talked about the embassy, the actual structure, which is a tent, like an army tent. What also strikes me is that these are the tents that they put up on country when they hand down native title terminations.
look, they're pretty handy. They're pretty
flat pack them. Yes, yeah. Ship them off. But this one is not the embassy because embassy itself is conceptual. It doesn't matter. The fabrication of the embassy itself is not important.
It doesn't matter what kind of tent, what colour tent, how big it is, how small it is. It's the idea. That matters. The idea behind the embassy, which is this, it's symbolic of Aboriginal sovereignty. And it's an assertion of Aboriginal sovereignty, the fact that whichever country I go to, we have an embassy, a conceptual embassy. So,
and in this embassy, it's an actual space for activism. Wherever the embassy goes, all kinds of conversations happen around sovereignties, our sovereignty, but sovereignties.
But also the social justice aspects that confront people, on a daily basis, like poverty, housing, medical needs and legal representation. All these things occur in communities. And this kind of arrangement where we get people in here to talk about, what it is that they're concerned about. What affects negatively their community. And they've all got ideas on what needs to be done to fix those problems.
Bring these issues home and the theft of the land, the continent, the landmass, bring it home to the power, the imperial power, the seat of power, is an important moment.
Well, it's all about symbolism, isn't it? This is a symbol.
Symbolism doesn't matter, Richard.
Pardon?
Symbolism doesn't matter to anybody. We've seen the coronation, eh?
Yeah, well, yes. So symbolism is important. We use it whenever we want to. The tent embassy is a symbol of Aboriginal sovereignty. It's a symbol of Aboriginal resistance. It's a symbol of Aboriginal cooperation. We have a flag. That's a symbol.
Material form of an idea, but never lose sight of the idea. The idea of the embassy is what you want people to focus on.
Yeah. So when they come here, they'll see and hear passionate sharing of stories, from basically this has been all around the world and there's been stories from all around the world.
And stories that even touched you and move you?
Absolutely. Just on the weekend, to hear the stories about how people were short of housing, so short of housing that they began squatting in houses.
Here in London?
Here in London. They were talking about they resumed 600 of those houses, and forced.
They were vacant?
They were vacant. And they broke in and changed the locks and moved families into them, and the council came, because they belonged to the council, they came there looking for their money and that sort of thing, and they were forced to deal with it with these people, and they weren't able to evict them.
Squatters' rights.
It was quite the victory there, so.
We all know about squatters' rights, don't we, in Australia,
blackfellas? Yeah.
The embassy is global, right? I mean, I know how I feel about the embassy when I see it, but conversations happen in here that aren't confined to Australia and to our issue, our property dispute.
No. When it was set up, it was set up in an international context.
The whole idea of an embassy is negotiation with an international or foreign power.
Correct. Yeah, so it is international from its first instance. The fact that there was an irony that we should have an embassy in our own country.
I think we take it for granted, right? The idea of the embassy. Yeah. Certainly, there's been a lot done to diminish the idea of the Aboriginal tent embassy. The media has not helped build the reputation. Why would it? But it is a negotiation with a foreign power. These Aboriginal activists in 1972 conceived of this idea, this crazy idea, to erect an embassy
Yeah, so it was so brilliant. You know, I made an artwork, you know, like nearly 50 years later. You know, like they're still travelling, you know, the world. You know, like and the fact that young people, you know, like 10 years ago, you know, like 12 years ago, 13, 14 years ago, were setting up Aboriginal embassies all around the country. You know, like not just in the big cities, but also in the country towns. That was the lasting effect of that action in 1972.
Can I ask you, I mean, a lot of the work that you've been doing since with this embassy project is to create a visual record or to remind people of the legacies that we owe, the legacies of the past, and how we need to honour and create almost a monumental archive which remembers what happened in 1972. That's become really important to you because I think you feel that there isn't enough respect paid. All movements, all revolutions need art.
Absolutely. I think artists have been involved in almost every revolution you can point to. And ours is no different. You know, like, we need artists. You know, like, at that protest in 1972, there were performances there by the Redfern Street Theatre. You know, like those performances, you know, convinced Gary Foley to take up performing.
Because the one thing that I'm reminded of is that there's so much we can do on the streets in that kind of pure form of activism, but you've found in art a kind of way to move even beyond that, and widen the conversation so that it actually loops in everyone who sees the artwork.
Yeah, well, this is certainly internationalised our struggle, which was reported back then in more than 80 countries. Like
this is the initial.
The initial protests were reported all you know, in 80 countries around the world, which is phenomenal. It's probably the first time
Australia's been in
protest had found its way to international shores.
The embassy conceptually has been in Castle. For Documenta,
yeah.
The same with the work that we saw in the entrance to the Turbine Hall. Where will it go next? I mean, can it go any higher than the Tate Modern and the Turbine Hall?
Yeah, I think wherever it goes, you know the venues are of a similar stature. They all sort of speak to power, you know, opposite, facing, or inside. You know, like these classic structures, these monumental structures. Or you look at places which have power embedded in them. So this speaks to power.
The Tate is a powerful institution. I mean, there's power in this building. There's power in why there's the money that created and built this structure.
Yeah.
Power is in art. It's embedded in art. But you can be subversive from within. I love how subversive this work is. Wherever it goes, it questions the structure that supports it.
Yeah. So here's some of the performance from those street theatre guys.
So there's always something to see in the embassy. These films.
Yeah, we'll play films, on a monitor inside the embassy. So
a bit of interpretive dance there. Here's Gary Foley on screen. Yeah. They talk about Basically Black, you know, the sketch comedy, which was a review before it was a television series that didn't get off the ground because the ABC wouldn't screen it. But Basically Black, you know, so much happened in that moment, and we were able to project ourselves the way, how we saw the world, inverting everything.
Yeah, well, Basically Black preceded
Did it precede the embassy a little bit? Or was it after?
No, that's right. It came after the embassy and just before Whitlam. The night that it closed was the night Basically Black closed. The Whitlam government was elected.
Elected power,
yeah.
And you remember that? I mean, things changed, we thought they were going to change forever.
It was monumental. You know, like
the ground shifted.
Yeah, the ground shifted. You know, like they brought in policies, you know, that the Conservatives on both sides of Parliament, you know, like have tried to erode. Ever since, you know, like it's very difficult for them to remove Medicare because it's such a popular policy that I think any government tried to get rid of that, I think they'd get voted out very quickly.
There's an arrangement, an exchange between the Tate Modern and the MCA, and works are acquired fairly freely between Australia and the UK, and loaned, exchanged back and forth. Is this work part of that arrangement?
Yeah, this work is part of a program between Qantas, which puts up the money, and the Tate Modern selects the works that they want to buy from Australian artists. I think the MCA, you know, has the thing for purchasing some British art. I think that's the way that it goes.
And it's important because it continues the relationship between Australia and the UK, but it also is a way of kind of acknowledging the artwork that's being produced by mob like you.
Yeah, well, I think most of the works that have been purchased by the Tate have been by blackfellas. I don't think I'm wrong on that. Like, so I think that's a fair reflection of, you know, the strength of Aboriginal art in our country.
And it says something. It's always a dialogue with power. And those dialogues are really important. When we lose ourselves in formalism and in things that don't matter, really. I mean, blackfellas don't have the luxury of just... Let's just talk about the white square on a white square, on a white background, or... You know, you can't do that. You can't just dissolve into the concerns that obsess many other artists. Formalism, for example. You can't do that. You can't descend into that kind of, unconsciousness. You have to make work about power and the loss of power.
Yeah, well,
and that irritates me sometimes. Blackfellas have to... We're consumed with just surviving and challenging when we should be able to create work of the imagination that is untethered.
See, I haven't had time to think about that.
Too busy surviving. Yeah. Too busy fighting.
Yeah, well, yeah. Basically, that's how it is. I'm too consumed with the fight. I think what needs to be done. There's so much that needs to be done. You know, like the conditions for our people have not improved. You know, like we have housing problems. You know, we have medical problems. We have problems with children still being taken from us in numbers that have not been approached in the past. We have problems with our education systems. You know, we have problems with land issues still. And there's no end to the problems in front of us. You know, so if I had nothing to make art about,
You'd move on to something. You'd do something else.
Retire.
You'd do something else.
Yeah, I'd do something else. I'd find something else that I really enjoy doing.
Play golf?
I'd rather go fishing. I'd rather go getting oysters off the rocks. I'd rather do something like that. Go out with my mates, hunting or whatever. And then sitting back eating it. It's nothing better.
On the riverbank, I reckon. You said something to me once, and that is, we have to imagine victory. So the moment beyond, when you win the war, for example, proverbial war, and you get what you have been asking for, how do you then move beyond it? You see, we have to imagine victory.
Yeah.
And you use your art to imagine victory.
Yeah. I imagine that our lives would be very different to what they are today. We wouldn't be stuck in this daily grind, this daily capitalist grind. I think that we'd have a much more varied life than what we have now. I'm not saying that we'd be sitting around on our black asses. All the pictures that you see of blackfellas almost just after contact. Those guys were ripped. They had six packs. That was, the definition was just there in their muscles. And this was all the guys. I'm not suggesting that we'd have an easy life. That suggests that they didn't have an easy life. That they were very active.
But all those early colonial artworks where you see Aboriginal people, they're always sitting down. Yeah. They're always defeated. You challenge this, and people that who've become personal heroes of mine. I'm here in London because, yes, to see your show, but also to visit the grave of an activist, Anthony Martin Fernando, who also went to the embassy. This is Australia House in London. If you don't know who Anthony Martin Fernando is, look him up, people. I said these two things are not unrelated. What you're doing here, erecting this embassy, the seat of colonial and imperial power, is not different from what he did, lobbying and picketing Australia House in London in the 1920s and 30s. But you're going to be painting a portrait of him too.
Well, I'm going to paint an image of a black fella.
We have to imagine what he looked like because we don't have a photograph.
Yeah, we don't have photographs. So I'm going to paint a conceptual Anthony Martin Fernando. You know, like with the tiny skeletons that he attached to his coat. You know, like in as a protest. It was like performance art in way before its time.
Yes, it was.
Incredible man. Richard, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time with me, and thank you for making this work.
Okay, no worries. Thanks a lot, Daniel, and all you people back in Australia. I hope that everything's going fine. Like, just hang in there.
Richard Bell with the art show's own Daniel Browning, who travelled to London to see Richard's show Embassy, which has been installed in the Turbine Hall of the Tate Modern. And the show includes a new incarnation of the work Richard made for Documenta 15, a guesstimate with compound interest of the rent owed by Britain to Australia's Indigenous people. Last time Daniel checked, the bill was 666 quintillion. This is The Art Show. I'm Rosa Allen. Come with me into the studio of Makiko Yujin, an artist who's equally at home with a wood lathe and a blowtorch. Picture a delicate wooden bowl turned from green eucalypt and looking pretty nice as is. Then it's set on fire and burned to a crisp black shell. Makiko's sculptures do stay intact and they're quite strong underneath that charred exterior. They bring a quiet weight to a space, looking like they belong equally outdoors and in. I visited her at her studio in a suburban industrial block.
My name is Makiko Yujin. Most of my works are made out of wood, and I do turn them on the lathe and then shape them, but after that I burn them. It's not my intention to change the form, but the fire changed the shape of the form of the bowl that I create.
But they're sculptural, so they're not for using.
Not for the bowl of miso soup.
Unless you want a sort of charred flavour.
Yeah, or that you may lose the soup before you drink it. We are looking at the lathe that used for the wood turning. And this is where I sculpture the piece. I can show maybe the process so you can kind of get the idea.
Yeah, let's get an audio picture.
Initially, I thought, I'm going to make a bowl for the St. Andrew Market or like a hippie market, some wooden works. But then I was at the time, I was at the place called Space Tank, and there was a lot of different artists and makers there that who was experimenting with their material, and they inspired me to, maybe I should step further in than just to maybe make wooden bowls. The burning was something that it's really clicked in me that made me thought, I want to go a bit further with this.
Burnt wood as well seems like it fits in very well with the landscape. Were you inspired by fire here or bushfires?
Bushfire was not the main thing, but I really like the view of the charred, burned wood, but new growth coming up. It's something that I never seen in where I grew up in Japan. Just the strength of that nature that it's not end, it's the start. And that kind of, what do you call it, the cycle of life was quite just stuck in my head for still now, I guess, that it's quite vivid memory of landscape that I saw here.
So when you're creating these charred forms, it's not the end of something. This is a transformation.
Transformation is always one of the main theme that I work with, yes, yeah. I was high school student in Japan. I was depressed high school student, actually. Didn't go to school that much. From the place called Gunma, the city is Takasaki. It's countryside. They make a lot of, maybe people don't know that, good luck charm doll called Daruma. It's paper mache, and at the start of the year, people draw eye on the face of the that doll. It's kind of weird. Can I show you?
Yeah.
And at the end of the year, we draw another eye, just the kind of...
So to conclude the year?
Or? Yes, conclude the year, but also the to thank or appreciate that the wish was came through, kind of, yeah. So, yeah, I don't wish too much, so I can draw another eye at the end of the year, a bit like I can live through the year without any death or the trouble. And after we draw, we burn them. People get gathered and make some sort of the fire, like a bonfire, yeah.
And then you burn them. Okay, so that's why you're comfortable with burning things you've created.
Oh, yes, yeah, definitely. That people in Takasaki, they make dough to get burnt at the end of the year. So that's kind of the, I thought that's crazy idea that craftsmen make it so carefully and they knowing that they only get burned at the end of the year. But yeah, it's a lot of good memory from that fire. Local ladies comes and make really delicious warm soup and we eat. Everyone who comes gets served, and also we make the that sticky rice, stick onto the twigs and...
Toasted?
Yeah.
Delicious.
Yeah. It was the kind of the year that all the children be able to play with the fire, which not quite allowed to do during the year. It's, yeah, very exciting. Do you want to see that next stage after the shape?
The next stage? Yes, I do want to see the next stage. Mikiko's gone to find her all-important tool, the lighter. She's got these beautiful wood-turned bowls sitting up here on a concrete slab. And I can't believe she's going to burn them to a crisp. You've got the lighter, you're turning on the gas. All right, stand back.
I can keep going and push the edge of this experimental method, but I just decided.
You think it's done? It's cooked?
It's cooked pretty well, I reckon.
It's interesting. Yeah, I think it looks beautiful. I guess there's you want to make sure that structurally it's going to hold, but then it's got these beautiful cracks all through it.
That's right. The cracks happens with the fire, but also the green wood. The moisture of the wood is escaping quickly after the timber becomes so quite thin. They lose the moisture and that lose the structure of the cells and the crack happens.
So is this going to be permanently sooty to touch when you sell it?
There's another stage where I put the natural wooden wax or oil.
One thing I'd like to know is how stable the end product is. They kind of look strong and delicate at the same time, yep. But like they might crumble under your touch.
Yes, it does.
It does?
It does. It's very fragile. Some of them are thick and it's strong enough to hold and move around, but some of them, if you touch it with a bit of force, that breaks. Yeah, fire is get used quite often in the making process. Or if it's not fire, it's some sort of like uncontrolled nature force is get used. And I choose fire for now.
I see correlations with ceramics. I mean, obviously the use of fire, you almost seem to be more closely aligned with ceramics than traditional wood turning. Yeah. Do you have any background in ceramics?
Cultural
inspiration.
I get inspired a lot by a lot of ceramicists. They create textures with all different kind of method. And that transformation too, I guess, that before kilned and after kilned is quite similar, I guess. That, yeah, I definitely admire a lot of ceramicists.
Makiko Ryujin. Find links to her work on the Art Show program page. The artist, designer and activist David McDermid never really separated his freedom as an artist from his own human rights. He was the first person arrested at a gay liberation protest in Australia. That was out the front of the ABC, no less. And when he became HIV positive, he turned his creative energy to fighting bigotry and spreading witty, angry, empowering messages to the queer community. Almost every year since his death in 1995, David McDermid's work appears in a new art exhibition. 9 years ago, he was the subject of a major retrospective at the National Gallery of Victoria. His rainbow aphorism posters have been exhibited on the London Underground, and earlier this year, his photography was shown at Sydney World Pride. Over the decades, his reputation has actually grown from when he was alive, unlike many of his contemporaries who died tragically young from AIDS. Before he died, David asked his friend, Sally Gray, if he could make her the executor of his estate, and it would be her responsibility to ensure that his artworks lived on in the public realm. And Sally has kept her promise. I sat down with her at her home in Melbourne.
In 1975, I'd just come to live in Sydney from London, and I was with my then husband, Brian Sayer, and we went to Paddington Market, which was quite a centre of fashionability, I suppose. And Peter Tully had a stall selling his jewellery and what was then called tat, stuff from op shops. And David was there. They were ex-lovers and very close friends and collaborators. So the four of us just looked at each other and it was kind of instant recognition, both visually and I suppose culturally in a way. We just all looked at each other and went, oh, yes. Very quickly, we were in each other's households, at each other's parties. And David and I developed a particular relationship, which I would call a discussion relationship, a talking relationship. We were immersed in all the social and political changes that were happening then.
What kind of art was he working on when you met him?
Well, I got to know his art from his first show in 1976, which was the show called Secret Love at Hogarth Galleries, which was the first kind of out gay liberation art exhibition in Australia. And they were sort of halfway between agitprop work and a kind of personal confessional kind of work. And also, there were collages and drawings, that was the mode. The work traced gay icons in film and literature and art history. So he was, through that exhibition, he was both positioning himself in a trajectory, which was about gay male cultural history, and making propositions about his own sexuality.
And maybe unsurprisingly, in 1979, he moved to New York to enter that art scene. What did he find there? What was his reception like?
Well, he wasn't received. He was emphatically not received. He didn't find his way into the New York art world. He formed associations with people like Keith Haring, but on the level of like having a mutual drug dealer or something like that, not on the level of David ever being given a gallery show. And he wrote to his mother saying how frustrating it was that he was being totally unrecognized and his work wasn't of any interest to the current downtown art world.
You've described David as having an unfashionable interest in craft and decorative art and textiles and sewing, and incredibly diverse too, like a hugely diverse output, and he was prolific. I'm wondering how he worked.
He was a dedicated creator, whether it was creating a fabric painting for Linda Jackson's fashion output or his own work or graphic design, like his poster design was amazing. He just went for it. Yep, I'd say he was energetic in his pursuit. And towards the end of his life, he was unbelievably committed to getting the work out.
He went to New York with the view of settling there, right? And it didn't happen. He was diagnosed as being HIV positive. And was that the reason he came back to Australia?
It was. So he was diagnosed in 86 and he came back to Australia, to Sydney in 1987. From 84 onwards, there was a lot of tabloid provocation and, well, there was a huge moral panic, mischief-making, and it was really just the role of the then Labor government and the health minister, Neil Blewett, and people around him and all the activists who became these incredibly world-leading AIDS activists who changed all kinds of things to do with government support for the gay community and appropriate medical intervention and appropriate educational approach to how to handle the epidemic. But it was hideous. It was completely hideous. And people didn't want to know gay people. People didn't want to touch gay people. It was quite amazing. If you're at a dance party and someone handed you a water bottle, it was like, I can remember thinking, I'm going to drink from that water bottle because I just don't want to be part of the moral panic. I want to be what we now call an ally. I want to be in it, whatever it takes. And so that's how it was. Like, I was a straight woman. I didn't have any, I wasn't dying. But my friends were dying. I watched people one after the other and I had to decide, well, what was my attitude to all of that? Like, how was I going to be involved? So it was a roller coaster, but I wouldn't want to suggest for a minute that it was a roller coaster for me the way it was a roller coaster for gay men. That would be absurd.
You mentioned earlier Peter Tully, who David had a relationship with and a long friendship with, and who also passed away from AIDS in Paris. He was a jewellery designer and a designer, and he was an artistic director for Mardi Gras in Sydney. What was the effect of his death on David?
Yeah, that was a huge drama because Peter died without a will in 92, 3 years before David died. And because he died without a will, David had tried to get Peter to create a will so that his work, his legacy could be managed and his work could end up in museums. And in fact, that's not what happened. And that was a hugely sobering thing for David. It made him personally incredibly furious, but also it made him very focused on his own legacy. And he'd been reading literature from the United States, from the gay community, about the management of estates and in particular the management of artistic legacy in the face of the AIDS crisis. And David actually gave talks about artists' estate management in conjunction with the Arts Law Centre and Sydney Writers' Festival to spread the word that, you know, denial wasn't really the way to go, you know. You had to face the fact that this was it, and if you wanted your work to live on, you had to make a plan.
So, Sally, when did David ask you to be in charge of his estate?
It was in 93, was 2 years before he died. And when he first asked me, I was very intimidated. I'd already said to him that I would be there for the whole thing, for the end, in whatever way he wanted me to be there. So I'd made that kind of declaration at some point. And I remember the conversation. It was in his studio in Ivy Street in Chippendale where he asked me. And at first I said, well, I'll have to think about it because, you know, it's a huge thing and it's pretty intimidating and I don't know, I've never done it before and, well, who has, you know. But he did, in the course of our subsequent conversations, he did say to me, because I'd said to him, surely it's more appropriate politically for one of your gay male friends, not all of whom were HIV positive, to be the manager of your estate. And he said these unmistakable words to me, which were the only words really that were the words that needed to be spoken. And it was something to the effect that you understand my work better than any of the gay men I know. And that was it. It was like, all right then, if that's what you think, okay, I'll do it.
What was your sense of the work then at that point? I mean, he'd done, you know, as I mentioned, it was so diverse, his output. There was graffiti, there was those fashion collaborations with Linda Jackson, disco quilts, you know, a whole variety. What was the volume? Was it all in that Chippendale apartment? Were you sort of standing among it while you had that conversation?
Well, a lot of work had been distributed over the years to friends. Like, he was a great gifter of work. So the amount of work that was left was not that great. But actually, when I look back on how much I distributed, like, for example, to the NGV, the volume of work that the NGV owns, I think, oh my God, there was actually an enormous amount of work to be distributed. And so it was like that work was in my house in Surry Hills for like ages while I negotiated with different institutions about who would receive what gifts. And Ted Gott, who's currently Senior Curator of International Art at the NGV, was a great advisor to me at that stage because he could put me into the framing of which curators and which institutions would be most receptive. And of course, the work had to go to institutions with the right curators, because of course the whole point was for the work to be seen.
As he was coming closer to death, he found a new rigor, a new energy, and he started making these rainbow aphorisms. Did he envision a life for his art after he died?
Absolutely. He always wanted to be famous. He did. He wanted to be famous. So there was that, but also he was very keen on the upcoming generations of young gay men. He wanted his work to speak to future generations. And, yeah, he wanted his work to live. He wanted it to be seen. He wanted it to influence. He wanted it to speak. And he just didn't really become famous in his lifetime. He was getting some exposure towards the end of his life. He was starting to be exhibited in his contemporary art as opposed to his fashion work. His fashion work was taken up early and was shown in major public art museums. But very little of his contemporary art was shown in major state art museums. And that was starting to happen. For example, he was, Judy Anear curated him into the last Perspective of Australian Contemporary Art in 1995. Ted Gott curated him into his AID show, Don't Leave Me This Way, in, I think, 93. So he was beginning to just sort of edge his way towards major art museums, which is the way careers are made. It's not enough that your work is seen by your friends and it's part of a queer world making. If you want to be famous, the route to fame is through the state art museum. And I knew that's what had to happen.
And that did happen in 2014.
It did. It took 20 years to pull that show off. And lots of people got very impatient along the way and began to get quite fractious about the fact that nothing was happening. I tell you what, I was, every time I was in Melbourne, which was once a month, I would make sure that I spoke to curators, that I never let it go. I just kept on and on and on. And the other thing was, and this was, again, Ted Gott advised me to do this, when I made the major gift, which was to the NGV, it was on the condition that the work would be shown in a major retrospective. That was a condition of the gift. And the work was not to be shown until that retrospective happened. And then with the other gifts to Heidi Museum of Art, where, you know, there were all these friendly curators, Jason Smith, Ted Gott, John McPhee, these different curators who were very friendly to McDermott's work. With each gift to a major art museum, there was a commitment on the part that the NGV had to do a retrospective and that the other institutions were not to show the work until this major retrospective had happened.
I can see that Paul Yore is actually part of the legacy of David McDermott. But there's, you know, the issues on which he was making activist art have changed. There's not an AIDS epidemic in Australia now. Taboos have changed or diminished. Did David envisage that that would happen and that his art would play a different role, or are you sort of navigating the meaning of his work now in today's world?
I feel now in 2023 that David's work is historical. In 2014, I didn't think it was historical. I thought it was still contemporary. It still spoke with a huge and relevant voice. It's definitely an enduring voice, but I'm quite immersed in Paul Yore's work and have, you know, spoken about his work and the looseness of his politics and his work could only be now. And David didn't have that freedom, yeah, that's what it is. It's freedom. So, in other words, he was a product of his time, and that's what we all are. I am. We all are. That's the way it is. That's what mortality is, you know. But yeah, interesting question, that one.
Dr. Sally Gray, executor of the creative estate of David McDermott. His work is held by numerous state and private collections. That's it for this episode of The Art Show. Thanks to producer Lisa DeVisi and sound engineer Elise Simons. And don't forget to follow us on the ABC Listen app. I'm Rosa Allen. I'll catch you next week.